It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. While a lot of good stuff can come along with holiday get-togethers, here's one holiday tradition most of us could do without: awkward conversations with family about difficult topics like politics, religion, lifestyle, and money. Common attitudes about personal finances can put a lot of pressure on people with consumer debt, a low credit score, or minimum wage income. Our next guest says it's time to flip the script and find a new way to talk about money and budgeting. She recently wrote a newsletter about how to have those tough conversations as the holidays approach. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you navigate conversations about money and finances over the holidays? Do you have questions about how to steer the conversation in a positive direction or advice to share yourself? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Dana Miranda is a certified educator in personal finance and author of Healthy Rich, a newsletter for inclusive, budget-free financial education. Dana, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Before we get to the holiday table, I want to talk about your approach to personal finance a little bit. A lot of personal finance is geared toward, you know, people with some finances to manage. Could you talk a little bit about the approach you take with Healthy Rich?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's for everyone, sort of regardless of your income. But I definitely speak to people that the personal finance industry tends to ignore, which is, like you said, kind of assuming that people have extra income to work with. So I take what I call a budget-free approach to managing money. And it's basically a rejection of what I call budget culture, which is the dominant approach to money in our culture that's rooted in restricting how we spend, putting a lot of shame on our financial decisions, and aiming for wealth as the goal above anything else.
That may take a lot of people aback. There's a lot of pressure out there to say, you know, budget your money, manage everything you spend. That's the road to not overspending, first of all, and to saving money for the future. Why do you see a problem with that kind of budget-centered mindset?
So I recommend the budget-free approach as a way of rejecting that act of budgeting itself, because it's a step in rejecting those ways that we're teaching and talking and thinking about money in our culture that we learn through budget culture that kind of encompasses what I see as budget culture. And that's in particular and really relevant to the conversation that we're having today, is because it encourages that shame that hurts us as individuals, but it goes a lot deeper than that, because it teaches us to place blame and shame on individuals and treat money as solely an individual issue that we're each responsible for, and causes us to ignore the systemic forces that impact our financial circumstances.
And part of what you're looking for, as I read your newsletter anyway, is to try to remove some of the stress we feel around money, whatever income level we happen to be at. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. I think that money management and thinking about money should be something that's easy. It shouldn't be something that takes up a lot of time in our day. It shouldn't be something that causes stress anytime we want to make any kind of decision, because money sort of folds into any sort of decision that we make. And I see a lot of personal finance advice, especially around things like budgeting and spend tracking, that actually add more work and stress to your money management. So the approach that I recommend is always to think about money less. Think about it as little as you can throughout your day, and let money just sort of be a part of your life as it kind of naturally is in the way that our society is organized.
Again, before we move to the holiday table, people might think, well, I don't seem to have enough money. I want to try to get a handle on it, as opposed to reaching for that, you know, budget app or whatever. What would you suggest they do with that as their starting point?
At that point, I would start with the mindset work of a budget-free approach, which is to start with thinking about your relationship with money. So a lot of times when people say they don't have enough money, if you step back and think about your relationship with money, a lot of what people are experiencing, again, is some of that shame and restriction that comes from budget culture. So maybe they're feeling like they don't have enough money to spend on the things that they want because they're using it in ways that education or personal finance gurus or just culture in general is telling them they should be using it. And so they're feeling that restriction, or maybe they're feeling shame because of decisions they've made or because of debt they've taken on or because of the amount of money that they're earning. But just making that mindset shift can be an accessible way for anyone to improve their relationship with money without making any of the changes to maybe your income or spending that would sort of be the next steps based on what that mindset shift teaches you.
Talking to Dana Miranda, certified educator in personal finance, author of the newsletter Healthy Rich. We're talking about how to handle difficult conversations, maybe at a holiday get together when money and finances come up. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Is this something you encounter maybe at your family get togethers in one way or another? The number is 800-642-1234 to share your experiences, your questions for our guest. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@wpr.org. Dana, let's bring things to that get together. What kind of toxic money conversations do you see people encountering maybe at that family get together?
So it's a lot of what I see in budget culture and the ways that we talk about money in general, because our sort of cultural approach to money is kind of accepted as the norm, as that's kind of what calling it a culture implies. And so a lot of things get brought up, especially in families when there's that extra stress and kind of expectations involved. But people throw out things about money without really questioning how it's impacting the people around them and how it's an expression of that greater culture and kind of what the implications of that are. So there's a lot of talk around the holidays of how expensive the holidays are in general, how expensive gifts are, a lot of talk about prices. And that can bring up all of those kinds of feelings about money. Again, that depending on how somebody's talking about it, it could really imply a need for restriction. There could be debt shaming involved, depending on how you're spending around the holidays and how that's impacting your finances. And there can be sort of this implied kind of expectation about how you're supposed to use your money and how you kind of should have prepared your finances for the holidays. And if you're not in that position, that could be a really tough conversation to have.
And you mentioned expectations. The first thing on your list is manage expectations at the holiday get together. And this could be true for difficult conversations where money comes up or just about anything at that holiday gathering. How do we set that expectation level?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're completely right. This doesn't apply just to money conversations. It's anything. The number one piece of advice I've heard, and I don't remember the first source, but this is not mine, but it's to remind yourself that grandma's gonna grandma. And it's a really easy thing to remember, so I like to throw it out there. You can put anybody's name in there. So like Aunt Joan is gonna Aunt Joan. Swap in whoever it is that you're dealing with at a family or holiday gathering. It just means that you can't change who these people are. We're assuming that you're spending the holidays with them because you love them, because you enjoy their company. And so there are things about them that you love with everybody that you know, and especially with family who you know so well and you're so close to. There are going to be things that get on your nerves a little bit, that irk you a little bit. And you just have to know that those things are going to exist. Don't go in because you've spent the year learning and sort of changing your relationship with money and learning about economics and finances, that you're going to, you know, go into this and hope that everyone else is going to be talking about money in a different way. Go into it knowing that they are who they are, so that you know what to expect, so that you can have reasonable expectations and prepare in advance.
One possible awkward interaction might be, and this may come up in some families or groups of friends, why are you still working that job where you don't make much money, or some kind of judgment along those lines? How do you handle that kind of conversation?
With anything with a job, I think, again, know sort of what to expect going in, especially for people who have sort of trouble thinking on their feet or just having conversations with people in general. Think about what the critiques might be, and then really, you know, ask yourself where you are with that. So for me, if somebody is critiquing my job, I tend to choose my jobs based on the interest that I have in them, the joy I get out of them, much more than the paycheck. And so I always focus on that, that I just say, I'm really enjoying the work that I do, and here's why. And just keep the conversation there, keep it focused on that, rather than feeding into their expectation of what your income should be. You don't have to respond to, you know, how you're making ends meet despite that income. You don't have to play into suggestions of different jobs or anything if that's not what you're looking for. Just focus on why something is working for you, and keep the conversation there.
Dana Miranda is with us, Wisconsin-based certified educator in personal finance, author of Healthy Rich, a newsletter that takes an inclusive approach to personal finance. She's with us to talk about navigating tricky conversations about money during the holiday season, especially if you've taken a different approach to managing money, to budgeting maybe, than others in your family. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What does money talk look like, if it comes up at all, at family gatherings? Maybe something you encountered over Thanksgiving or worry about coming up on the Christmas and other holidays. Is this a source of tension in your family, or is it avoided altogether? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Wisconsin personal finance writer Dana Miranda about how to prepare yourself for holiday budget talk, with talking points even for those difficult conversations about money. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Is this something that comes up for you at family gatherings, maybe over the holidays? Does some version of money talk spoil the get-togethers for you in one way or another? Do you have experiences or questions to share? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Marcus joins us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hey, Rob. So my great uncle Don, when he was alive, he used to take, and at holidays, he told us, he said, you know, and just in life in general, you need to separate your wants from your needs. You should always cover your needs and occasionally cover things you want. And he said that even applies to us at Christmas. And so rather than just, because we'd have our list of toys and whatever else that we wanted, and he was trying to teach us a larger lesson. And he said, you know, like, I'm going to give you something that you need, even though you don't know you need it. And so he would take us out, and we'd go out into the country, and he'd teach us about nature, about different types of trees, ash, you know, aspen, pine, whatever. And basically what he was trying to instill in us is that, you know, the money covers the wants and some of the wants and the needs, but the wealth that he was giving us was the knowledge, understanding, and just a whole different perspective for the rest of our lives. And it has done me a good stead. And I can't express this enough. It shouldn't be about the dollars for a toy, because that's short-lived. Memories, though, it stays with everybody who's involved in that activity.
Marcus, thanks a lot for the call. A couple things there, Dana. First of all, that nature trip, for example, focusing on really a non-financial good in a lot of ways, a shared experience, exposure to nature, things like that.
Absolutely. I love the message that the wealth that they were receiving was the wealth of knowledge. And I think that that is something that gets completely ignored in personal finance, is the different types of wealth in our life. And the much more fulfilling for many people, the much more fulfilling types of wealth to pursue than dollars in a bank account or dollars in an investment account. Those experiences and those shared connections are really important and you can't put a dollar amount on them. Sometimes achieving them does cost money, like owning the land to have access to go out and look at the trees, or traveling to be with your family at the holidays, or having the technology to connect with them or something. You do have to put money into that and have that kind of access. But like, because like I said, money, you know, just gets folded into every part of your life. But if you can really listen to yourself deep down and understand what is the true thing that you're trying to get out of that experience, I think you can come up with something much richer than a certain dollar amount.
Thanks a lot for the call, Marcus. We'll go to Chad now in Sauk City. Chad, hello.
Hi, this is Chad. How's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Chad?
I was listening to the conversation, and I feel like the idea of being stressed about money is something people with less money or people that manage their money poorly should be stressed about, because money equals freedom. And the more money you have, I mean, I've lived very, very with less income, and then I've made lots of income. And the more income I make, the less I have to think about money. But the less income, you got to budget a little bit more closely. And I just think that you're selling a bad idea to people if you're saying, oh, it's don't worry about it. It's either make more money or budget more tightly. That's my two cents.
Chad, thanks a lot for the call. Dana?
I do hear this a lot in conversations about budget culture. And I think that Chad actually did a really good job of sort of exemplifying what I see in budget culture, which is this idea that this very individualized idea that every individual person is responsible for their financial circumstances. And so if you have less money, that you should in effect have less of an experience. And if you have more money, then you are entitled to more of an experience. And that in reality, there are some things that if you have access to fewer resources, you do have to do a lot more work to make the decisions that you want to make in life, because your money is tighter and it's more difficult to do those things. But the approaching it in this way and recommending that the step that someone should take is to either earn more money or to budget, which is essentially to spend less money in most cases, ignores any systemic or cultural or social forces that put someone in that situation. And so I like to pull back and take an approach that allows people to see how our systems work and to see how those systems are impacting their financial situation so that they can make decisions within that system with the reality of how they're living within that system, and not just take advice from people who have been able to succeed within that system because the system was built for those people to succeed.
Chad, thanks for the call. Talking to Dana Miranda, author of the newsletter Healthy Rich, which aims at inclusive, budget-free financial education. Getting back to our holiday get-togethers, another recommendation you have is going, if you know certain things are going to come up, going in with some canned responses at the ready. What kind of things do you suggest having in our back pockets?
Yeah, absolutely. So in general, I think a good sort of rule of thumb when you're dealing with conflict in a conversation with someone is that kind of old psychological advice of focusing on I statements. And so focusing on how you feel and what you think, rather than taking the bait to get into an argument or letting somebody steer you in a direction that doesn't make sense for you. So if somebody is talking about, like I mentioned earlier, how expensive the holidays are, or they're talking about holiday spending in general, if you're taking a budget-free approach, I recommend something along the lines of, I'm focusing on gratitude this holiday season. I'm not depriving myself. Just sort of suggesting I don't support restriction. I don't have that in my life. And for judgments of your purchases, which you might hear judgments of someone else's purchases, or you might hear somebody talking in the same way that we do about food, sort of putting judgment on their own purchases. Just mention, you know, I've been learning about this a lot lately. I've been learning about personal finance, or I've been learning about my relationship with money. And I'm trying not to think of spending as good or bad. I'm just enjoying the experience, again, focusing on gratitude this holiday season.
One of our callers who couldn't stay on the line mentioned the topic of shame, and maybe shame being a good way to motivate us to stay within our means, to manage our budgets. And I keep hearing in a lot of different fields, and you mentioned weight loss as another one, Dana, shame being kind of a counterproductive tool to the ends we want to meet. Can you talk about that a little?
Absolutely. You're completely right. I don't have a study in front of me, but studies after study has shown that shame is not a good motivator for people. Studies have also shown that restriction doesn't work. There's a lot of that in weight loss science and in dieting, but we're seeing it a little bit more in budgeting too, that that kind of restriction and shame just doesn't work, especially in the long term, but even in the short term, people are not, it's not helping people achieve financial goals. It's really just making people feel worse about themselves. And the most likely outcome is just that they'll go into hiding and be less likely to share their situation with the people who are shaming them.
Dana, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Dana Miranda, Wisconsin-based certified educator in personal finance, author of Healthy Rich, a newsletter for inclusive financial education. She is with us to share some strategies for changing the way we talk about money during the holidays. Remember, you can follow these conversations all the time, anytime, online at WPR.org, or you can download the Wisconsin Public Radio app for live streaming and archived material as well. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to The Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. The World Meteorological Organization says that 2023 is set to finish as the planet's warmest year on record. That mark comes as world leaders are meeting for the United Nations annual climate summit known as COP28. Recently, the U.S. government's Global Change Research Program released its latest climate assessment report, highlighting the dangers of this rising global temperature for Wisconsin and the rest of the country. In our state, average temperatures are rising and extreme weather events are becoming more frequent, including droughts, floods, and excessive heat waves. These climate changes are already impacting Wisconsin in areas like agriculture, water management, infrastructure, and public health and safety. Our next guest has been researching ways to limit Wisconsin's contribution to climate emissions and to adapt to a changing climate. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see the impacts of climate change in your life or your community? What areas are you most concerned about? Are you optimistic we can prevent further harms from climate change? Do you have questions for our guest about the latest research and what it means for Wisconsin's future? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. James Bolter is a professor of chemistry and chair of the Department of Public Health and Environmental Studies at UW-Eau Claire. Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. Nice to be here.
Now, I think for a long time we've talked about global warming and then about climate change as something that affects us in the future. We keep seeing reports that show it affecting us in the present. Can you talk about some recent examples of where we see climate change having an impact here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, well, you know, I think that's really been a major shift that we've observed in the past decade or so. And I think we're all, public opinion would definitely bear that out, that we're all feeling like we're experiencing climate change. I think locally, the one that people are most aware of is just the horrendous air quality we suffered from this summer. I know talking with my students and how many of them were personally affected by it. And I know we all know people in the community who maybe have underlying health concerns, asthma, an underlying heart disease or respiratory illness, for whom it was particularly problematic, right? So that would be a really sort of banner year for climate impacts here locally. But I think people who are closer to the land will notice things like, you know, ice on dates are getting later and later. Ice off dates are getting sooner and sooner. We're seeing greater disparity between extreme dry and extreme wet. We saw that even this past summer, where we had, you know, a lot of drought throughout the spring, and then we sort of caught up during the summer with rainfall. So a lot of things like that.
The actual rising temperatures themselves, I've seen, I think it's in this new report and some data you shared with us. We might not notice the extreme heat because a lot of it is sneaking in, warmer nighttime temperatures, warmer winter temperatures. Can you talk about that stealth heat and the kind of impact it can have?
Yeah, well, you know, I think people a lot of times will see reports from the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the committee, the United Nations Committee of the World's Greatest Climate Experts, and they'll see reports that, wow, we've warmed 1.1 degrees. And they'll say, well, what's a degree, right? There's a couple of different ways to answer that. One is, you know, a couple of degrees when you're talking about your internal body temperature might be significant, right? But in terms of the climate impact, I think we're less concerned about the sort of global average temperatures and the fact that when we experience those increases in average temperatures, we also increase the frequency of the extremes. And that's, I think, where we're seeing more and more emphasis on the research as the models are able to bear this out, is that we're seeing more and more of the days over 90, the day in this part of the country, in the Southwest, we're seeing more and more days over 100, over 110. And those have really substantial health consequences.
And you look at farming and agriculture a fair amount, and timing is everything, I think, when it comes to temperatures and moisture, precipitation, things like that. What kind of worries do you have in the next few years, even when it comes to farming and the timing of things like when rain falls, when snow melts?
Well, you know, to be totally transparent here, while I do study agriculture in the sense of it's a part of the science of climate change, I am by no means an expert in agriculture, and I certainly won't pretend to be. But you know, the kinds of things that we're seeing is with extreme rainfalls, and I'm going to say this, but folks who are out in the fields will have experienced this and have a much better impression of this than I do. And I encourage them to call in, maybe even with their own experiences. But you know, with extreme rainfall events, you know, a couple of years ago, farmers having difficulty getting into their field for planting. And then we have an extreme drought event for you know, maybe a couple months. There's real concern with corn yields. And in fact, I think there was even some concern with corn yields this spring, certainly, although we did catch up quite a ways on precipitation and later in the summer. So it's that inconsistency. In fact, one of the outcomes from the latest National Climate Assessment, that NCA5 you mentioned earlier, was looking at exactly that. How frequently do we switch between extremely dry to extremely wet? So that sort of frequency of that climate flip within a single year. And even that's projected to increase with climate change.
Talking to Jim Bolter, chair of the Department of Public Health and Environmental Studies at UW-Eau Claire, looking at the latest report on the impact of climate change in the United States, with a focus on the Midwest region as well. You could join in at 800-642-1234. You heard Jim. We want to hear from farmers and gardeners and people who enjoy nature or get out on the ice and are waiting for ice to show up on lakes. If you've had a personal experience of climate variability, climate change that affects your way of life, your way of recreation, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Jim, you've done some presentations on how Wisconsin can reduce its climate impact and also mitigate climate impact. what kind of things would be at the top of your list?
Well, you know, if the goal is to reach what is generally referred to as net zero, and I'll talk more about that in a moment, then, you know, there are solutions that are held in common across the country and across the world to some degree. So what is net zero, right? To reach net zero, and the target here is about 2050. So it's not that far off, right? 27 years or so. Net zero is the situation in which we are not putting any net greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And that is, any remaining greenhouse gases that are emitted by human activities are taken up through some other actions. That means the complete phase out of fossil fuels. And that's a very difficult thing to even envision, right? We're so dependent on them. And to be fair, they have vastly improved our quality of life over time. And while they have incredibly negative environmental consequences in terms of the air we breathe, water quality, they have really been the primary factor that has determined what the modern developed world's lives look like. So how do we get there? There's four steps. Step one is first of all, we need to electrify everything. What does everything mean? Our cars? Sure. Yeah. Our hot water heaters? Definitely. Our stoves. Even our furnaces, and here that's a hard thing to do. So we look at using heat pumps, air source and ground source heat pumps. So we electrify everything. Then we decarbonize the grid. What does that look like? Well, it means moving away from coal and natural gas to solar and wind and nuclear. And that's actually happening quite rapidly as it is, just because of the economics. And then finally, we need to, two last things. We need to decide what can't be electrified. And we need to then offset those emissions through some other way. And we also need to eliminate emissions of the other greenhouse gases, methane, nitrous oxide. And those are really important regionally, because those are so often tied to agriculture.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Pat is with us in Madison. Pat, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to share an observation and get your input on it. But I'm a stream monitor as a volunteer. And this year, the water body that I monitor has been pretty much dry throughout the year. And in speaking with my counterparts, they've commented similarly in the watershed around here, but also statewide, it's becoming a trend. And it's kind of tied in with the development in the communities where there's, you know, kind of a rapid construction of housing projects and so on, like multi-unit housing, where there's not a lot of consideration given to the rainfall being able to return to the groundwater because of the paving. And just the policy clash of the development is under state law. One of the ways that communities are allowed to raise property tax revenue, but then it comes in conflict with actually allowing the hydrogeologic cycle to kind of play out normally. So we're seeing water bodies kind of dry up statewide, and that's been shared with me by counterparts throughout the state.
Pat, thanks a lot for the call. And Jim, I know monitoring water quality and water quantity are both important issues here, especially if we're seeing cycles of drought and heavy rainfall.
Yeah, I appreciate Pat's comments there. I also appreciate that she's involved in citizen science monitoring of our rivers and streams. That's so important. So a couple thoughts there. It does heighten the conflict between development and preservation. But, you know, at the same time, there are a lot of good solutions that can allow development to proceed while still protecting our hydrogeologic cycle, right? There's a lot of green infrastructure that we see a lot out west, but maybe we need to get better at doing that here in Wisconsin. Things like, recharge areas. So we make sure that the water that's falling, especially when it comes in more intense bursts, has a chance to set on the ground and then slowly percolate down and to regenerate that aquifer. So we see things like rain gardens, for example. A lot of college campuses, I know our campus has several rain gardens that can actually be extremely beautiful, utilizing native species, which is a benefit to biodiversity. So there's so many potentially good solutions here to this, the problem that she cites, which is very real, right? And while it's not exclusively a climate change issue, it has a lot to do with how we develop. How we develop has a big impact on mitigating those problems or adapting to the extreme rainfall events.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to UW-Eau Claire Public Health and Environmental Studies Professor Jim Bolter about the present and future impacts of climate change here in Wisconsin and efforts to mitigate that. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How big a concern is climate change for you? Are you seeing its impact already here in Wisconsin, maybe your own community? Join in with your observations, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk now with Jim Bolter, professor and chair of the Department of Public Health and Environmental Studies at UW-Eau Claire. He is with us today to talk about how climate change affects Wisconsin now and what could happen in the future as the U.S. government's Global Change Research Program released its latest climate assessment report. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us now in Belmont. Chris, hi.
Hi. I actually have two questions. The first is about 20 years ago, I read an article that stated that by the year 2100, Madison's temperatures would be comparable to what Miami's are today. And I'm curious what your opinion is on that or if you have any data. And my second is there are some people that believe that the temperature increase is just due to an interstadial period. And I'm curious as to what your opinion is on that also.
Chris, thanks for the call. First, that second point first, that idea that we're just in a period between glacial expansions, I believe is what Chris is referring to. So the warm-up is maybe normal and natural Earth cycle. Jim, what do you say to that thought?
Yeah, so I mean, the interglacial cycles are real. We have records of them in ice cores dating back over 800,000 years. The problem with that particular thought is that we are currently in an interglacial. So if you look at the historical record, you would expect periods of cold and warm to alternate. And we're already in the warm. So the fact that it's now starting to warm dramatically more so actually puts us into a climate paradigm, which we really haven't seen on this planet. Certainly for 800,000 years, if you look at the ice cores, but if you look at some other records, we're actually, I think, about 3.2 million years. We're well into the millions of years since we've seen this kind of warming.
Chris also mentioned the idea that we could have, you know, southern Florida temperatures in southern Wisconsin by the end of this century. Is that a thought? Like if things get really out of whack, we could see that kind of change?
You know, I'm not seeing the projections that would suggest that particular outcome. If you Wisconsin Institute on Climate Change Impacts, also known as WICI out of Madison, has done some really nice work on modeling for this. And last time I looked at that, it was more like Arkansas, sort of Missouri, actually more like Missouri, I think, by 2100, depending on the projection, right? And the projection depends entirely upon, more than anything else, upon what human actions are, how effectively we mitigate our impact on the climate. So a worst case scenario would be sort of like Missouri, sort of Kansas, Missouri sort of thing, not as much like a Florida. Again, because the climate in Florida is so heavily marine dependent, I think that would be less likely as well.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Tim joins us now in Winchester. Tim, hi.
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 Yeah. I'm a cross-country skier in northern Vilas County, and we barely have any snow here.
Have you been skiing for a long time, Tim? Have you seen changes over the years?
Yes, I've skied 25 Berkeys, and this is one of the lowest snow years so far. You know, my change on it, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Tim, thanks for the call. Jim, are we noticing things like later initial snowfalls? You mentioned later icing over ponds and lakes. Are we seeing that late start to winter kind of concern?
Yeah, not just the late start, as Chris mentions. And I've been up to the Berkey. I can't say I'm not the athlete he is, so I've never skied it, but I've been up there for it. And it's not just a late start. It's that, you know, a lot of times, and he's experienced this obviously many times in the past decade or so, where you get rainfall on top of snowpack and it just completely destroys the snowpack. So either you're not getting the precipitation. We're not seeing overall overall less wintertime precipitation as a really strong model outcome. But because it's much more frequently at warmer temperatures, it means it translates into less snowpack. And this is, of course, not just a northern Wisconsin thing. The entire ski industry is quite concerned about this. There's a lot of professional skiing organizations that have been really out in front in advocating for climate policy because they see really an existential threat to their sport that they love. To northern Wisconsin, that has more than just aesthetic concerns, right? There's an enormous economic impact to the loss of that snowpack, not just for skiing and the Birkebeiner, which are huge impacts in their community, but also for snow machines and all the rest and the tourism industry up north. So it's a deep concern, and I share it with your caller. It saddens me personally, but I find it concerning too for the state.
Tim, thanks a lot for that call. Jim, before we run out of time, I want to talk about some other human potential impacts of climate change. People have raised concerns that less harsh winters and warmer nighttime temperatures, things like that, could expand the range for different kinds of diseases that can affect humans and other mammals in the state. How big a concern is that?
Oh, it's a huge concern. I was just looking at data in that NCA5 report, that National Climate Assessment, and looking at, for example, Lyme disease counts by state from 2000 to 2019. And, you know, Wisconsin has the largest increase in Lyme disease counts of the entire Midwest, followed by Minnesota. And we also know that Lyme disease is vastly underreported. It's the most common vector-borne disease in the United States right now, and has really really awful consequences for a lot of people. In addition to that, we're seeing other vector-borne diseases in the southern part of the state, that even from mosquito-borne diseases, and that's something that that public health departments are watching very closely, but it is certainly a projection into the future that we're going to see more of what we would normally consider to be tropical diseases. Southern United States, of course, experiencing that quite strongly already.
In just our last minute or so, we've got this big international conference going on, the new report that we've been talking about here in the U.S. Are you optimistic, Jim, that policy and behavior changes are going to start happening and at least avoiding the worst case climate change scenarios?
Am I optimistic? As we're trying to wrap up the call, right? That's that's a hard question to ask. Is it possible? Yes. The models show us that it is possible. One of my favorite quotes that I utilize a lot is, we don't lack the technology. We don't lack the knowledge. We actually don't lack the economic wherewithal. We don't even lack the policy models to pull it off. What we really seem to lack is the will, political and otherwise. Do we have that will at the international level? We will see. COP28 in Dubai is an interesting setting, and that's a whole nother conversation. Mm-hmm. But I think it's drawing attention, even though I think they're maybe sweeping some of the need to eliminate fossil fuels under the rug at that conference. We are really seeing a lot of attention being paid to methane as an important greenhouse gas, a very important greenhouse gas. We're seeing more conversations about the health impacts of climate change. And we're also seeing how our food systems adversely affect climate change and how our food systems can evolve to both withstand climate change and also to mitigate our impacts on the climate.
Jim, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks so much.
That's James Bolter, professor of chemistry, chair of the Department of Public Health and Environmental Studies at UW-Eau Claire, with us today to look at the impacts of climate change in Wisconsin. Tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, it's Nice Work If You Can Get It. Dig into the art and science behind cheese tasting. Learn from the pros tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Last week on the show, we invited you to share some of the things you do to mark the changing of the season, from fall to winter, Thanksgiving to Christmas, or to the holiday season in general. This weekend, I did another one of my annual things, by which I mean I joined in a thing that somebody else organizes every year. A friend of mine hosts an annual gathering to make a wide variety of Norwegian cookies. I always look forward to it. She makes all the dough, has all the recipes and the equipment and the knowledge. Then the rest of us come over and do the parts that are hard to mess up. I only mess it up a little. When I have to turn dough into crescent or wreath shapes, they end up being crescent-like or wreath-like. My favorite is the krumkaka, which are pressed thin in a kind of waffle iron arrangement, then wrapped into cones. A friend of mine and I do those every year. Makes us feel like tough guys working with the burning hot stuff. I got by with only one minor burn this year. Plus, I think I singed off some of my fingerprints. Good time to do some crime. Plus, I ate lots of cookies and brought some more home. So all in all, great way to kick off December. This is Central Time.